Because it's time in time with your time, and its news is captured for the Queen to use. Welcome to the Saftacast, I'm your host Scott C. Episode 2 to the 7 is in your ear, live and in effect right now. Folks, there is much happening right now with Sundress Publications and the Sundress Academy for the Arts, so much that it is, like, hot off the presses, including a brand new imprint at Sundress Publications. Of course, for all the latest information, even before this podcast can get it out, you can visit Sundress Publications on the web at sundresspublications.com. That's one word, sundresspublications.com. Or on Facebook, just do a search for Sundress Publications and the Sundress Academy for the Arts to get all of your latest info. For now, let me focus on what is happening in the country with the world of writing right now. 11,000 or so writers, editors, and publishers are descending upon the city of Minneapolis, Minnesota, including yours truly will be there, for the annual AWP convention this week. You might be there, you might be on your way there right now. If so, then safe travels unto thee. Be it flying, driving, train, goat? Perhaps. Making a little Quanto Lagusta reference there. I will be there with the Saftacast in conjunction with Sundress Publications, the Sundress Academy for the Arts. You can come see us and learn about all the things I've been talking about all these many shows at the beginning of the program every time. In addition to learning about Sundress Publications, Sundress Academy for the Arts, finding out about the latest releases, including the just-released Mermaid Anthology, which will be there, and seeing some of the Sundress authors and getting books signed there, the Saftacast will be doing open interviews with anyone. Anyone and everyone. You want to be on this podcast? Stop on by in the dates that I'm about to give you, the dates and times. Come on by, table 527. They'll point you in our direction for this. We'll give you a 5-minute interview for a future episode to air in May, possibly June. We're going to cut all of them together. The dates for these open interviews are Friday, April 10th, 1 to 3 p.m., and Saturday, the 11th, 12 to 2 p.m. Come and visit us. We will give you a 5-minute open interview. No questions asked? Well, shouldn't say that. Questions will be asked. Oh, yes, they will. We really hope to see you and talk to you. We want to know what you have to say. Now, on to today's episode. The one and the only, Juliet Cook, is with us from Blood Pudding Press to chat about a number of things, including gourmet cupcakes, and even what it's like to pack for AWP and the complexities that are involved in such an endeavor. It's a great, great interview. Had a great time chatting with her. She is really cool. If you have the chance, I encourage you, check her out at AWP with Blood Pudding. She'll be with Menacing Hedge, also great press. Come and check them out as well. There are so many good presses to check out at AWP. Can you do it all in 3 days? I don't know. But I challenge you to. It's not really a challenge if there's nothing at stake, you know. Anyway, today's interview is a good one. I must warn you, though, up front, we had some technical issues and the sound quality may not be perfect, but nevertheless, it is a great interview, and I know you're going to enjoy it right after the theme song. Juliet.
Yeah.
Okay, so I always start off the episode by asking the burning question that is on everyone's mind.
All right.
Are you ready for it?
I think so.
It's a bit of a doozy. Recently, I got into a discussion about this. It's a long-standing argument with somebody. Is it okay to wear socks to bed?
Oh, boy, you are asking the wrong woman about that. I mean, the answer is a definite yes, but also I'm automatically going to, like, take it into some realm that might sound a little on the kinky side, because you're talking to a woman that has, I've been a fan of, like, knee highs and thigh highs for years. I mean, the answer is yes, it's okay to wear socks to bed.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to know. I mean, we'll talk about your sock fetish in a second, but I have been advocating for socks in the bed for years.
Yes! I mean, you know, wearing socks on your socks is what keeps you like warm in bed. I mean, at least, especially during the winter, for Christ's sake.
Exactly. My wife thinks I'm odd. She's like, I can't stand it.
Oh, whatever. That, yes, it's a definite, you know, it's suitable and it's also sometimes a necessity.
I've tried to go barefoot to bed and I will get up in the middle of the night and put socks on.
I have this little, like, these weird feelings about being invaded by insects in bed. And it's not like I have an unsanitary house or anything. It's just a little quirk I have. And so I always have to wear socks and panties to bed.
Thank you. I don't know. I don't wear panties to bed, but I do wear underwear. I can't go commando. Except when I'm wearing my kilt. Then I can go commando. Let's talk about this sock fetish, because I was told coming into this that you do have a bit of a thing for socks. Where did this all start with you? Do you know?
I wouldn't call it a sock fetish. I don't know. I guess it depends on the definition of fetish. Like, it's not necessarily a big sexual turn-on or something. But I can't remember where it started. But I know, I do remember, like, back in, when I was in college, I loved knee highs and thigh highs back then. So I guess it must have started in my late teens or early 20s. And I also remember that somewhere in my mid 30s, I think it was during a poetry reading I was doing. I could be wrong, but no, it wasn't during a poetry reading. But I remember my mom suggested to me that at this point in time, I needed to stop wearing the knee highs and thigh highs. I was too old for that. But I get compliments on them all the time, and the way one dresses has nothing to do with age, in my opinion. It has to do with your style, and, you know, if I'm alive to be 90, I'll still wear knee-highs and thigh-highs if I damn well please. What started my interest in socks? I just find them visually appealing.
What are your favorite pairs that you own? Just a couple of them.
Well, I don't like, okay, one kind of, you know, I don't care if other people just wear plain old normal socks, but what's up with, like, the average form of men's socks being those short white ones? Like, you know, my favorites would just be ones that are multicolored and have, like, maybe a fuzzy texture to them or some other type of special texture or some other type of special design. Like, a pair I recently got has little, it's kind of like dead skull socks. So they're black colored, but you actually see the skull parts of the leg as though you're wearing, you know, skulls on your actual legs.
Whoa. That's not just like a skull print, you're saying.
Well, it is. It's a skull print, but, you know, it makes it, you actually see these. And actually, that must be kind of like a favorite of mine to an extent, because I have, like, probably two or three pairs of tights that have skulls on them and two pairs of socks that have skulls on them. And then also I seem to favor the type of socks that come in clown socks. Because I know I bought a recent pair. I mean, I don't perceive them as clown socks, but, you know, the multicolored pattern there. Because I remember I bought a pair a couple months ago at a Halloween store, and they were in the clown costume section. But to me, they were just awesome socks.
So the more funky the socks, the better.
Yeah, I don't want plain old.
Yeah, guys' socks really just come in white or black, now that I think of it.
You know, I think of this, now that I started talking, I'm not going to be able to remember the name. Yes, I did. There's this online store called Sock Dreams, and they offer a variety of different socks, all kinds of different fees associated with them. Some of them are expensive, some of them aren't. But they have a women's section and a men's section, and they have, like, knee-highs and colorful knee-highs for men.
I might have to check this out after the show.
Yep, just go to sockdreams.com. And another good thing about them is they're shipping free. At least it was last time I visited.
They're not a sponsor. Maybe they should become a sponsor of this program. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
I want to keep this as free as possible and avoid the sponsors. So you mentioned you have a lot of the skull patterns or anything. Is that a motif in your clothing?
I wouldn't say it's a motif in my clothing in general, but I do have quite a few tights and socks that have skull patterns. And I do think that I became a little bit more, not necessarily on purpose, but I noticed that I became a little bit more akin to skull in general, like, probably, sometimes I have a little word issues. What are those Well, wait, I guess skull's the word. I guess I became more akin to, like, skull imagery after, like, I had a serious health issue a few years ago and could have, like, passed away. And now I just, like, look at skull. I mean, I'm glad I'm alive, but I find skulls, like, even infiltrating my poetry a little bit.
Yeah, I have my wife will attest, I have a thing for skulls.
Oh, okay.
Especially in my office, she got me a gold painted skull. So it's not real gold or anything. And I couldn't help it. I put sunglasses on it. There's something about a skull wearing sunglasses that I think is just so awesome.
Well, that's because also, to me, the first thing that pops into my head with that is it's not like you're not just looking at the skull and like skull equals death or something. You know, you're dressing it up.
Yorick would have looked a lot better in Ray-Bans. Alas, poor Yorick. Ye had good fashion sense. So, skulls are, yeah, there's something about it. I don't look at it as like, oh, I'm obsessed with death or something. There's just something cool about skulls.
Yeah, like, I find myself wondering, like, this, I mean, I'm sure this is the answer is yes, but I don't think a lot of people have analyzed this, but, like, how, like, does every skull look as different as, like, does every skull body when someone's dead look as different as, you know, every body when you're alive? That may sound like an odd question, but that's what just popped out of my head.
Well, no. Once you remove the flesh, all skulls pretty much look the same from the same species.
Really? They don't have any like, slightly differing sizes and shapes to them?
Well, I mean, a baby skull is much different than a human skull,
right.
But no, unless you're really trained in it, I would think the layman's eye would just say that looks like another skull.
I might have to analyze that further.
I'm not trained in it, so I can't tell, like, looking at it, this is from someone of Middle Eastern descent. No, I can't do anything like that.
I'm going to write myself a little note right now that says, analyze skull shapes and sizes.
I mean, you know, Neanderthal skull is very different than Homo sapiens skull, but...
Right. But no, actually, though, non-human skulls are really interesting looking.
No, animal skulls are pretty cool.
Yeah.
Do you ever go out and get animal skulls? Do you keep animal skulls?
I don't frequently search for animal skulls or anything like that, but I have one that I cannot remember how I got it. It's like the head or the face, the skull head of a, I can't think what animal it is. I wasn't 100% sure what animal it was when I got it, but it's a whole head, and it still had its teeth in there and stuff. It's one of, what are those, one of those black and white animals called? Medium shaped.
Skunks?
Not a skunk, but the, a little bit larger than a skunk.
Badgers?
I don't know. So, see, I have, like, this is the problem with me. I have, like, little word issues sometimes when it comes to easy little words, like food stuff, colors, shapes, sizes, animals, but I do have a small animal skull above my bookshelf, and I remember analyzing what it was, but now I guess I've forgotten. But yeah, it's not a skunk, but
something, some kind of rodent.
Yeah, some kind of rodent. Yeah. And then next to it, I have like a also the foot of a certain type of bird. It's not like I killed the bird or anything, but. You know, a friend of mine found it dead and cut off the legs.
Whoa. That's actually kind of cool.
Yeah.
Are people freaked out when they come and visit you?
I don't think so. I mean, it's not like I have a room that's inundated with animal corpses or anything like that. I have a fairly normal house. I have a little bit of art up here and there. My art computer room is just kind of like a cluttered mess because I'm always working on like poetry chat books and stuff there. So it's just there's no point in like organizing stuff and putting it in boxes because I'm always working on it. So there's just clutter all over the floor. You know, as far as creepy or scary goes, some people might not be into the kind of art I'm into, but it doesn't inundate the home.
What type of art are you into?
I'm into, I'm not into any one kind, but overall more like abstract visual arts, and I also create abstract visual arts. Overall, I guess kind of on the darker side, but also on the colorful side. I just like kind of like looking at abstract art that I can like in that my head can interpret in a way that's somewhat similar to interpreting poetry, but instead of being word based, it's I guess shape and color based and that type of thing, if that makes any sense.
That does make sense. So it's not like you're coming back to the idea of are people creeped out. It's not like you're after morbid stuff. You're after just interesting stuff when it comes to art.
Yeah. I'm not like, I'm not anti-morbid or anything, but I'm not purposely aiming for morbidity by any means.
Good art is where you find it.
Yeah. And I guess like, I know there was a time when I preferred planning like my visual interests not as morbid so much as maybe a little on the macabre side. I preferred saying macabre.
You and I are very connected then, because I also said it that way all the time. Finally took someone in like 12th grade to go, no, it's pronounced macabre. And I'm like, really? Macabre sounds better.
No, I think literally some people do pronounce it like macabre. It can be pronounced either way. And plus which, you know, when it comes to a word, even if you're pronouncing it wrong, if you like the pronunciation and it makes sense to you, I say stick with it.
That's another lesson I've got to teach some people about me. Like, no, the word's pronounced this way. I'm like, no, it isn't. So, you mentioned that you make art, too.
Yeah. I guess the main type of art I make is kind of painting, collage art hybrids, because I'll use canvases of different sizes, and I'll use acrylic paint, but it won't just be paint. I'll put I don't even really know how to describe it. I'll glob on different textures of stuff like yarn, googly eyes, stuff from flowers, stuff that like textures that stick up from the paint, and that also paint globs on top of the textures don't even let the texture stand out for what they are, but turn them into something different. So yeah, that's the kind of art I've been doing recently. When I was younger, I always could. This is interesting because in retrospect, it doesn't really make sense. But when I was younger, I considered myself, I'm definitely, a poet. But yeah, I make some art on the side, but I'm not a visual artist type person. And then in more recent years, I started thinking, what defines whether or not your art is real? And I realized that I was kind of like thinking, I don't have a college degree in art or anything, but big deal. Like, you need a, do I care whether or not someone has a college degree in poetry? No, I care whether or not I like their poetry. So same with art. I mean, I'm not saying I'm like some skilled, professionally trained artist, and some people wouldn't be into my stuff, but the process of creating it is meaningful to me, and sometimes the finished products are good as well, and sometimes they're not.
If somebody else likes it, hey, that's a bonus.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably just a few years ago that I started like putting pieces of my art up in my Blood Pudding Press shop, along with my poetry chapbooks, and it's not like I'm selling it up the wazoo, but occasionally I'll sell a piece of art and it makes me feel pretty happy. And occasionally I'll give a piece of art away. sometimes if someone invited me to do a poetry reading, whoever's hosting the reading will get a little piece of art.
Hey, another bonus, another reason to have it read. Might walk away with free art too. Were you always doing art? Was that something that you were into as a child?
I always had an artistic streak. As a child, my art was nothing like what it is now. Like, I just remember doing a lot of tearing things out of magazines and kind of making little collages out of it and that kind of stuff. But I didn't think of it as art back then. I just was interested in doing that. And I experimented with art. I had a phase of experimenting with visual art some like in my 20s. And then I just set it aside for a while. And then I found that I got back into it in my late 30s when I was having some serious word issues. And sometimes it was even harder than it used to be for me to like get the words out when I was working on poems. So I decided to just kind of visualize some of my thoughts with paint and other textures. And even though since my work's kind of abstract, like if someone looked at a piece of art, they wouldn't be like, oh, that means blah, blah, blah. It still worked for me to an extent. And plus which I started to, not only did I enjoy the experience, but I started to enjoy some of my finished products. So I sort of stuck with it and working on both of them now. Although poetry is still my primary passion.
But visual art has its place too.
Yes.
Do you see yourself branching out even further? Like in terms of the arts, do you see yourself like now trying your hand at music or video production?
Well, definitely not with the video production because I'm kind of like one of those, I mean, nothing against video production, but I like am not good at like audio stuff or figuring out how to do it and stuff. Music, I used to really enjoy singing when I was younger, but I just feel like my voice has gone downhill. So, I mean, those are types of things that, you know, I would enjoy as an observer, but not be interested in. I don't see myself getting into those things, you know, as a creator, per se. But, you know, other kinds of things that aren't necessarily popping into my head right now, I'm always open to trying new things. I mean, I don't want to stick to the same. I'm kind of an anti-mold momentum type of person. I don't want to stick to one mold for the rest of my life. You know, who knows what the future might hold.
You don't want to be just labeled in your bio as Julia Cook, poet.
No, and I don't want to, but speaking of poetry, though, like, one thing I don't understand about, like, poets even wanting to be labeled into certain realms, I feel like there's one realm of, like, academic poets, and then another realm of outsider writers, and that type of thing, and, like, I don't really want to fit into any particular realm, you know, some academics relate to my poetry, and if some non-academics relate to my poetry, good, but I don't feel it fits into any particular fold or mold or realm. It's just my poetry.
What about not even just highbrow, lowbrow, academic and public? What about all the different subgenres of poetry? And you have a lot of poets saying, like, well, I'm a narrative poet, or I'm a lyrical poet.
I guess my take on that is, I mean, that doesn't bother me or what have you, but, you know, we all define our own poetry in a certain way, but that's not necessarily how other people define it. That's what I think, because I feel like my poetry is, I don't know, like sometimes I feel like my poetry is more abstract than it used to be, but then other times, like, I'll write a poem that I feel is kind of, like, a little on the overly obvious side, and then, like, I know what my poems mean to me, but that doesn't mean that they have to mean that to someone else who reads them. I mean, other people can interpret them however they choose to and stuff. And so that would deal with content and, you know, whether it's lyrical or abstract or overly obvious or what have you. I just feel it's open to interpretation. And I know what my interpretations of my stuff is, but other people can interpret it however they want to.
So the labels, in a way, are kind of bullshit.
Kind of. I don't know if I'd use the word bullshit, but they don't, they're not like any type of, they're not like a set in stone, like, this is the realm I fit into type of thing. And then also, like, along somewhat similar lines, I feel like, you know, we all know, well, not we all know, but poetry's not particularly mainstream, but despite that, what is with, like, sometimes I feel like there's all these little, like, popularity contest in poetry land. It's like, I don't know, the little under the table popularity contest in a field that's not even that mainstream, you know. And I'm not trying to fit into any particular group. I mean, I like having friends that are poets and all, but I don't care about whether or not I'm a popular poet or an unpopular poet or what.
Yeah, for the listeners who don't follow poetry, there is a bit of, like, almost high school popularity strata within poetry.
Yeah, I don't get it. I wonder, and I don't know the answer to this, I wonder if that social media stuff takes that up a level, maybe?
It might. It might increase visibility for some, might connect people to new audiences, possibly, create more followers.
Mm-hmm.
I could see it definitely playing a factor. The ones who use it effectively can draw a lot of response. Let's face it, just like any other art form, there's a lot of ego and narcissism to go around.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, it still bothers you that there is this popularity contest going on.
It's not like something that I'm, you know, incredibly bothered by, but I find it, okay, it shows me, like, some of my own contradictory personality issues, because on one hand, I couldn't care less. Like, I'm not writing my poetry to please anyone else or to form an audience or anything like that. I'm not aiming for popularity. I don't care whether or not a bunch of people relate to my poetry. But on the other hand, and I think this is probably the case for a lot of poets, obviously it makes you feel good if a small handful of people do relate to your work or do find it powerful or meaningful or whatever. And sometimes with, this certainly doesn't apply to everyone, but sometimes with the type of, with some of the writers that seem to gain a lot of attention through, I don't know how, through the certain kinds of the popularity realm, it doesn't even seem like it's based on their writing so much as how they sell themselves. And I myself have contradictory issues with promotion and stuff. Like, I'm definitely alive on the social media scene. You know, I promote my work to an extent, and I also promote the work I publish, and I also promote poems by poets I don't even know that I just happened upon online and liked the poem. But I don't know, I like have a hard time deciding if I'm over-promoting or under-promoting and how to promote and how to draw attention and if you're doing it for the right reasons.
I see where you're coming from on that. I don't know, if you feel like this. Personally, if I sold, I'd rather sell one book to someone who really enjoyed it and got something out of it than sell 10 copies.
Yeah, me too.
I'd rather someone get something. But yeah, there is, it is kind of weird from an observational standpoint, the sort of popularity game that's played in poetry.
And it could also just be, it could also be too, like, just different people perceive it different ways. Like, maybe it's not even a popularity contest. I mean, maybe some people are just way more sociable than others and that type of thing. Like, I'm not anti-social or anything, but I'm not, like, some social butterfly type person. Like, I'll do poetry readings, but I don't know. Like, I'm not a big, other than when I'm reading the poetry, I'm not, like, some big performer or seller of myself, I guess. And some people are kind of, like, performing and selling themselves even when they're not reading their poetry, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. You, to a degree, you have to sell yourself a little bit at every reading. But some either go over the top with it, or they're more skilled at that than they are at writing or reading.
Just like it, like any realm. I mean, even though poetry overall is non-mainstream and stuff, I mean, there's going to be tons of different personality types and tons of different styles and tons of different approaches, even in a small scale. I feel like I'm using the word realm a lot, whatever. But yeah, so, I mean, the only reason that type of stuff stands out to me is because, you know, poetry is one of the main things I'm interested in and one of the main things I'm staying on top of. But that probably happens in everything.
Yeah, I would think in every realm. Yeah, I'm using your terminology here because I think it's a great word for it. Every realm makes it sound more regal. But you were just saying is that poetry is really only just one of your realms, though.
It's definitely my primary one, though.
It's your primary, but and visual art is another. Where else? What other realms do you control?
I don't know if this is a realm, but I'm really into communication. And, you know, not just communication in the form of poetry and art. Granted, those are my primary interests there, but just communication in general, but not, like, big group blather type of conversation where it's all like I guess I'm not into any type of like fake easy talk, and I'm into like intense interpersonal communication. And there's a lot of people that aren't into that. There's a lot of people that are just into like small talk or a group performance art conversation. And I am more of like a very, very, very small group or one-on-one conversation / communication. And it bothers me sometimes how like some people really don't want to communicate, don't want to be honest, don't want to show any parts of the real them, and that's not a realm I'm into or a passion of mine, but I've always been a very communicative, honest, straightforward person, although, you know, I also have mixed feelings and all of that stuff, so straightforwardness is going to, like, mesh into various different directions, but I don't know. Poetry, art, communication. Socks.
Socks, definitely.
Cupcakes, maybe. Gourmet cupcakes.
Gourmet cupcakes and wine. That has to be an interesting combo.
Well, they're not necessarily, you know, consumed at the same time.
Oh, okay. Because I'm like, well, there are dessert wines, and cupcakes are kind of desserts. we'll come back to that here.
All right.
This communication aspect. So what you're kind of talking about is the real human connection between an intimate group of people, one, two people, three people.
Yeah, like sometimes you'll be in a small group setting, and the talkative people aren't necessarily talking to an individual. They're talking to the whole room. Almost like it's a performance art or something. And I just, I'm a big fan of having an interpersonal connection with one individual or two people, you know.
No, that makes total sense. I mean, just speaking as someone who is obsessed with narratives and personal narratives, I love getting to know people and getting to know their story. Who are you?
Right. Fairly often, I don't want to exaggerate this or whatever, but I will sometimes have people tell me that, like, seem like they're surprised by how honest I am or how willing I am to, like, reveal certain bits of information about myself. But I guess I just don't understand why more people don't do that. I mean, I understand some people, you know, like to keep certain things to themselves and aren't very expressive and only like to share certain kinds of information with certain people, and that's fine. I don't know. I guess the part I don't understand, the part I don't relate to, and the part I don't like is fakeness.
That phoniness.
Right. You know, if you don't want to reveal parts of the real you, fine, but just, you know, stay kind of quiet then. Don't be phony and fake and revealing things that aren't even true or genuine.
If you can't say something real, don't say anything at all.
Right, just do a dance move.
Just bust a move.
Right.
Take young MC's advice.
Just do a zombie skull dance move.
You know, bust out the zombie jamboree and walk down the street, man. Multiple music references in one song, one thing there. When you reveal, I'm not saying like you're revealing, you know, secret, super private things, but when you say that you reveal things, do people respond in kind to that? Do they start revealing more of themselves when they realize that you're revealing some honest stuff about you?
It depends on the individual, but that certainly happened before, you know, and I had people tell me that, wow, you know, they haven't been able to like express themselves very much in front of many other people because other people don't seem interested. But if they're interacting with someone that will expresses a lot about herself, you know, and it's not like I just want to hear about myself, I want to hear about them too. So yeah, it brings that out in some people, not like a whole slew of people or anything, but every once in a while, I guess.
Why do you think that is? That some people will open up and respond in kind?
Because I think, and this has nothing to do with poetry land or anything. I think a lot of people are just mainstream conversation in general is largely small talk that doesn't include a lot of like personal details, especially not thoughts, feelings, and emotional details. And I think some people have just gotten so used to that. And some people are genuinely comfortable with that they feel like revealing what little parts of what's inside their head is wrong, or even if it's not wrong, that other people wouldn't be interested or that they'd be sharing too much, that kind of thing. And some people will just stick with feeling that way and don't want to share much information, fine. But some people, like just everyone they've, not everyone, but most of the people they've spent time with, you know, isn't interested in talking that way. And then if they find themselves interacting with someone that is an emotionally expressive individual, they'll share more parts of themselves too.
What surprises you about people when they open up to you? I know that's kind of a weird question.
Yeah, obviously that depends on the individual, but I guess, well, first of all, I'm not easily surprised, actually. but I personally find it surprising, like, when someone will, like, tell me something and they'll be like, you're the first person I've ever told this to, and it wasn't, like, some shocking, hideous bit of information sharing. So I guess I just don't understand the part of like why people feel like they can't share parts of themselves. I don't know. Like I mean, I'm not someone that's just going to share the positive parts of myself. I'll share my weaknesses. I'll share the negative parts of myself or whatever. And I guess some people think that any of your flaws should be kept to yourself and not freely revealed because it'll turn people off or other people won't get it. But, you know, when it comes to, like, any type of mental or emotional flukes, maybe part of the reason people think other people won't get it is because people just don't freely talk about that kind of stuff. But maybe there's a lot of people that have hints of those, have their own, you know, bits of those kinds of feelings. So that's another reason why I feel communicating about that kind of stuff rather than keeping it inside is far preferable. I don't know.
No, that you're right. Because it's not like they're saying to you, you know, I've never said that before. I was a heroin addict. Yeah, it was something shocking like that, but just something small, like, I wear socks to bed.
Yeah. Yeah. But another reason, perhaps, that some people are unwilling or reluctant to reveal certain parts of themselves is because there are a lot of people in this world that are overly judgmental, and maybe they feel it will, you know, elicit negative judgments. You know, I've never really been a judgmental person. I mean, there are certain things that I wouldn't be willing to deal with on an in-depth level, but that doesn't mean I'm not willing to listen to them in conversation.
I totally get it, yeah. So let's talk cupcakes.
Okay.
When did this whole cupcake thing start? Not with you. I'm talking about just the trend, because like 5 years ago, suddenly this exploded, the idea of gourmet cupcakes.
Yeah, I don't, I remember way before 5 years ago, like maybe, I'm terrible with timing, but maybe more like 15 years ago or something, I was looking at it must have been some type of magazine that had to do with gourmet food. I don't remember if it was specifically dessert product oriented or just gourmet food, and it had a dessert product section in there. But it actually had this really appealing article about gourmet donuts. And how this guy that created these unique gourmet donuts, but they were starting to be sold at like expensive coffee shops and other ritzy places and such. And I remember literally cutting parts of his descriptions of his own donuts out of the article because I'm like, oh, this could be a poem line. This could be a poem line, that kind of thing. But yeah, somehow the gourmet cupcakes thing has been going on for quite a few years. I don't remember when I became interested in it, but, you know, like with a lot of dessert products, some people are fine with sticking to the basics, and some people like gourmet ice cream, gourmet donuts, gourmet cupcakes. You know, with me, it, like, the gourmet part of it isn't because I want it to be expensive. It's because oftentimes the people that make those are experimenting with different kinds of flavors and, you know, more unique approaches to the matter. So I think that's why it appeals to me.
Yeah, it seemed like a trend that just came out of nowhere in my eyes. Just suddenly, there's cupcake boutiques on, you know, suburban corners all of a sudden.
Well, yeah, anything that, like, starts to suddenly gain popularity or whatever, yeah, it will become a bit of a trend for a while. But I think there were gourmet cupcakes going on, like, 10 years ago or even prior to that. It's just that it wasn't a big trend yet. I can't remember how I got into them, though. I think it's maybe because, you know, I've never really had a chocolate fetish or anything. Like, I'm not anti-chocolate, but I'm not like, oh, chocolate, you know, and I'm not a big candy-based person, but when it comes to my sweet tooth is stuff like ice cream, donuts, and cupcakes.
Everybody got their thing.
Right.
When it comes to it, I'm not a big chocolate or candy. Chocolate's fine. I'm not a candy person either.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I am known. My secret one, and when it comes to desserts, is do not get an ice cream cake near me. When I was working one of my jobs, somebody had a birthday and they brought in an ice cream cake and they put it in the fridge. And so on lunch break one day, they're like, oh, Scott, you can have a couple pieces or anything. They came back 45 minutes later and I had destroyed the sheet cake of ice cream. And they're like, did you just eat all that by yourself? Yeah.
There you go. But when you combine ice cream and cake into one, do you stick to like just standard ice cream, like chocolate or vanilla, or do you like special flavors of ice cream combined with your ice cream cake.
My personal favorite is the Carvel chocolate layer, cookie crumble, top layer, and then the weird vanilla top, and then that weird kind of sugary frosting they put on top.
Okay, I don't think I've ever tried that. That sounds rather appealing.
It's so simple, but it's so easy. Sometimes simple is best.
I actually kind of like along the ice cream spectrum. I am a fan. It's not something that I'm consuming every day or every week or even necessarily every month. But I am a fan of malt. And even though, like, when it comes to ice cream, when it usually comes to ice cream, I like unique flavors rather than chocolate or vanilla. I am a fan of vanilla malt.
What exactly is a malt? I don't think I've had one in a long time.
Well, I don't know it. I don't know exactly what it is. It's basically just, you know, they put the malt stuff in the ice cream. And I think the malt stuff is just, I think you could buy the malt stuff if you have the malt stuff. I don't know what it is. It's certain grocery stores and stuff, but I've never bought it and made my own malt, although I guess I probably could. But it's just the flavor of the malt just adds a whole different appeal to an ice cream drink. It mostly just changes the flavor. And even though the standard malts are like chocolate or vanilla, like occasionally I've tried it. Like, I think this started less than a year ago when I decided, I might try some different flavors of malts too. I guess I had been reluctant as to how the malt flavor would combine with something that wasn't plain old chocolate or vanilla, but I found out that it also works pretty well with pumpkin-flavored ice cream and with black raspberry-flavored ice cream.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'm thinking the pumpkin.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like how everything became pumpkin spice. But I could see that. I'm curious now. I might have to start experimenting myself with malts. That, and it's a fun word to say. Malt.
Yes.
Sounds like some kid's name. Hey, malt.
And, you know, malted milk balls.
Now, those I do like. I
had one of those in years, but...
It was weird. It, like the Whoppers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to be okay with those.
Yeah, me too as a kid.
It was always...
And I probably would be okay with them now. I just haven't had one lately.
I have the feeling that both of us are going to be hitting like a grocery store after this podcast. So we were talking about malts. I gotta get a package of these and try these. When it comes to ice cream, I love ice cream. Ice cream, I think, is one of the most glorious things that mankind has ever created.
Okay.
But I am not one to sit down and eat an entire pint in one sitting.
Yeah, me neither. Like, if I think of one of those small batches of ice cream, like Ben and Jerry's, the sizes that those come in, like I would maybe eat half of one in one sitting, but even those I wouldn't eat a whole one in one sitting. If you're into ice cream though, I imagine you're probably familiar with this brand, but maybe not. Have you heard of Jenny's Blended Ice Cream?
Actually, I have not.
Okay, well, it was for many years I lived in Columbus, Ohio. And it was this Columbus-based woman that started her own unique gourmet ice cream establishment. But in more recent years, and maybe it's just in Ohio, I don't know. But in more recent years, you can actually find her little pints of ice cream at like various grocery stores and other places as well. And oh my gosh, you can, if it's not available in your area, you can check her out online and order some to be mailed to you. Now, her ice cream is on the pricey side, but it's so good. She comes up with, like, new flavors. I think, I don't want to say necessarily say every few weeks, but every few months she'll have an assortment of all new flavors. And then there's certain basic popular flavors from her brand that she'll stick with, but then come up with new ones, you know, every so often.
Wow, I'm going to be up in Ohio this summer, briefly. I might have to stop in somewhere and see if I can get a pint or something and check it out.
Yeah, if you're in the Columbus area, you just want to take this place called the North Market, which is one of those places that has all these little food shops inside and all that. You can stop in there and get some of it there. North Market.
So it's just like an open-air market?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Always good to know this. So you were in Columbus for a while?
Yeah, that's where I lived for, I don't know, much of my, like, basically shortly after I graduated from college up until, I think.
Are you a native of to Ohio?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was, as a kid, and my parents still live in this area called Valley City, Ohio, which is a very, I mean, it's increased in size in recent years, but it's a very small town area. Like, when you're entering into that area, there's this sign that says, "Welcome to Valley City, the frog jump capital of Ohio."
That is definitely small town vibe right there.
Yes. They had this annual, I think it still exists. I haven't been to it in recent years, but they had this, like, annual event that, like, they still have a Valley City Street Fair, and but they also had this annual event called the Frog Jump, where basically it consisted of all ages from kids to adults. There would be this competition of, like, who could get their frog that they brought in to jump the fastest across this display of jumping frogs, and everyone had to, well, not everyone had to, but people would name their frogs, and I kid you not, in my elementary school, I don't remember the details of this, but some room mother had created this giant frog, and, like, not a living frog, like this, she had created this giant frog art piece, and each, I don't remember how you won the frog in front of your classroom, but everyone wanted to, like, win this frog, whose name was Jumpin' Jupiter, to be in front of their classroom door for the week. And even in music class, the music teacher had even created this song based on Jumpin' Jupiter. So we sang it in music class. But then, you know, I went to college in Bowling Green, Ohio, and then. And the main reason I chose that was because, you know, number one, I couldn't afford some expensive college. Number two, they, at that point in time, they, like, I knew I wanted to get a BFA in creative writing, not just English with a creative writing sci or what have you. And that was one of the only schools around here that offered it. And then shortly after graduating from college, I moved to Columbus and lived there for many years. Now I'm in Medina, which is not nearly as small town as Valley City, but more small town than Columbus. You know, I'm not like an anti-Ohio or anything, but I'm not a big fan of winter. So I'm probably one of those people that if I hadn't been bored, I mean, you know, I was born in Ohio, but it's not like my dream state or anything. But also I'm not a real location-based person. I think, you know, basically what's going on in your head, not where you live. But the area I live in now doesn't have much of a poetry scene. Well, it doesn't have any poetry scene, but it's relatively near Cleveland, which has a good poetry scene. But I'm a non-driver, so that sometimes makes it a little difficult.
Yeah, I've been in a dead zone in Florida when it comes to poetry and the arts.
Okay.
East Coast, it's like, okay, West Palm Beach has something, Orlando has something, Fort Myers has the Fort Myers, Sanibel Island Writers Conference, Miami, where I am, no, dead zone.
Wow. But that's one good thing about, you know, online, like even for years when I lived in Columbus, I mean, granted Columbus has a college and all that has like a creative writing program, but at that point in time I wasn't associated with the college or anything, and at that point in my life I really was not real sociable, but most of my poetry interaction was online, and that's how I met a lot of people that some of whom I've ended up meeting in person in more recent years. You know, I am a big fan of, like, initially meeting someone online and becoming a big fan of their poetry, and then later actually getting to meet them in person, that type of thing.
And, you know, there's that great opportunity coming up. Actually, this episode is airing just as it begins in Minneapolis, AWP.
Yes, and actually last year was my first time ever attending AWP, and it was awesome to see, like, quite a few people that I had been aware of, you know, name-wise and poetry-wise and, you know, knowing what they looked like online for years, and actually got to encounter them in person. The only thing about, this is probably going to be my second and probably my last AWP, though, because I just feel that the prices involved with it are way overboard.
Oh, yeah. Especially students and people who are young writers.
I think when it, you know, up until more recent years, it was largely focused on collegiate presses. And, you know, if you're with college presses, I'm sure the college covered most of the expenses and stuff. And I think it's just in more recent years that a lot of more independent presses and small-scale presses also started getting involved with AWP, which is a good thing. But, you know, how are we supposed to cover those costs? Last year when it was in Seattle, a whole small group of us stayed at a Poetry Friend house in Seattle, so that took away from, well, that removed the, you know, hotel costs. But still, you know, you have your, ordinarily you have your plane, hotel, mailing in a bunch of your books and stuff in advance, the table, blah, 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 blah. It's, oh my gosh.
Eating, transportation, well, right, taxis.
Right. Exactly. I mean, there's no way you're going to earn any money at that event. I mean, you'd have to sell like 1,000 books to even get the money back. At least I would.
I think you're not alone in that. A lot of, you know, I wrote a blog post about for new attendees, one of those AWP guides, and I said that it costs a lot of money for these small presses to come to it. So, you know, help support them. Mm-hmm. Give them, you know, even a couple of bucks makes us happy to get us going in there. Because, yeah, it's, I don't know. It's just, I think it is getting a little more expensive for, and again, I agree with you. It's great that small presses, independent presses are going to it and taking over the book fair, but it's also, it's a tough thing to do. But there is, though, that homecoming aspect that that you mentioned. I will say that I'm going to be there, or I am there right now as this airs. Time travel is weird. Like 2/3 of the SAFTAcast guests are going to be there. I'm going to meet them for the first time in person.
Cool. Yeah.
Are you looking forward to it this year, though?
I am looking forward to it. I'm a little bit, and this happened last year as well. I'm a little bit, I don't know, I don't want to exaggerate. Maybe frenzied would be a slight exaggeration. But, you know, I have just, like with my chapbooks that I make for my press, I just print and design them at home. So I have just been printing and designing chapbooks left and right. And I just recently, like less than a week ago, announced the new first of 2015 Blood Pudding Press chapbook. And on one hand, I'm really glad that, you know, it's already selling. But on the other hand, I'm like, oh my gosh, how am I going to have enough copies to take to AWP and all this? And I don't know. Like, I mean, I'll get it done, but it's just, I've just been frenziedly working on that stuff for like, I feel like about a month now. And then I'm one of those people that does not like flying. Like, it's not even so much the flying part itself, it's the airport part. Like, I'm kind of phobic about airports, and I'm always a... So, I mean, I'm definitely looking forward to AWP and will enjoy it once I get there, but I still have, like, a lot to get done and make myself not be all, like, frenziedly worried about before I get there, I guess.
I'm sure you're not alone. This is the side that a lot of those AWP guides don't talk about, is sitting there going, how many copies should I bring? How many copies are reasonable? Should I have this there as well? How much table space am I having?
One kind of interesting thing, and you know, I don't know if this would always be the case or if it was just last year, but one interesting thing I noticed last year, I basically had, you know, the chapbooks I had the most copies of were the most recent chapbooks I had published. You know, the chapbooks I had published that year and the very most recent one. But the thing is, you know, people that are walking around looking at the tables and stuff, you know, unless they happen to be someone that's familiar with your particular press, they didn't really seem necessarily focused on what was the most recent or not. So I sold, like, close to just as many non-recent chapbooks as the recent ones, that type of thing.
Yeah, you really can't predict.
Yeah.
Every year, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of new attendees. You know, new writers who are just exploring, and they come across whoever. And maybe it's the name on the sign, your press's name. Maybe it's the person at the booth. Maybe it's just something on the table that catches their eye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You have no idea what's going to be your bestseller during the convention.
Mm-hmm.
But it is fascinating to look at the tally afterwards and go, wow, I did not expect that.
Hmm. It also seemed to me last year that you were more likely to sell copies of chapbooks if the writer was actually at AWP.
I don't know. But I understand where you are in the franticness of like, how many should I bring? What if I don't sell any of this? Then I've got to carry them all home with me.
Right.
Ah! And then, airports.
And then also the factor of telling yourself, all right, I have like so many unread books at home. I have so many unread books and chat books. I do not need to buy a big bundle of additional chat books at AWP. Yeah, right. You're going to end up buying a whole other bundle of chat books there because how can you not?
And then there are things like the Ducey Collective and such, where you're going to come home with 20 if you're in on it. I know because my wife is one of them, and we'll come back with like 23 more chapbooks, and they're all really awesome.
I was involved with the Ducey Collective for several years too. That was an interesting like mailing and receiving things in the mail experience. It was pretty awesome.
Oh, I'm not. I don't want anybody to mistake it. I think the work that comes from mom is amazing.
Take up a big part of the, the ride, the flight back.
It takes
up bundled with Deuces.
It takes up valuable real estate in a bag. When you're flying, every inch counts in the bag.
I know. I am a little, due to my discomfort with flying, I usually just take one large carry-on bag, and then one suitcase. The type of suitcase that I can actually put above me in the plane. So I have to like figure out, and this particular year, I did not, and I'm not planning on mailing my chapbooks in advance. I'm just taking them with me. So I have to figure out how to like stuff 6 days worth of clothing and then a bunch of chapbooks in, one suitcase and a carry-on bag.
With the knowledge that you're going to be coming home with even more chapbooks, maybe.
Right.
Whew. And then, of course, the wallet hit, of course, when it comes to the book fair. No matter what you set as a budget, you will go over.
Yep.
Oh, it's going to be a fun one, but I hope you and Blood Pudding have a successful run there.
Yeah, I'm splitting a table at this one with Medicine Hedge.
Ooh.
You know?
Well, I will definitely have to stop over and say hi to y'all.
Yeah, and same with me. Yeah, like I made a point last year. I mean, obviously, like if you have a table, you want to be seated at your table a lot. But since I'm splitting a table, I'm sure she and I will take turns touring the scene and checking out the other tables and talking to other poetry people.
So, you have to.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have to take some time away from the booth, get someone to cover for you, so that you can wander to other booths of even your old friends and be like, I haven't seen you in 2 years. How you been?
Right, right. And, people that you've never even met before. Like this, I remember last year, I mean, there were many people I was excited to meet, but I was absolutely thrilled, like so giddily excited to meet Patty Payne because her online literary magazine was one that, like, probably in my, like, I don't know, probably, like, around the time when I first started to become a little bit more widely published, I was so excited about her online literary magazine that when she accepted my poetry, I was just thrilled. So it was awesome meeting her, among many other people last year.
Yeah, there's something wonderful about just running into someone and going, I know you're so-and-so?
Yeah.
You really exist? So, well, I hope Blood Pudding has a successful run there, as I said. I hope you guys have a great time with it and gain some attention and fans. So I will definitely have to stop by and check you guys out and vice versa. And of course, and then there's the swag aspect. That's what I wanted to say. I know that I'm supposed to fill my bags with books, but sometimes there's something so awesome in swagland. I know that one, I don't know what one's doing it, is having rubber duckies.
Oh, neat.
I don't know. Yeah. I can't remember who that is that's got it this year.
I hope they're multicolored rubber duckies.
I don't know. I saw somebody posted a picture of, like, getting ready for AWP. Come find us.
Yeah, and last year it was like there were a lot of press, like, this seemed to be more of the case with larger scale presses, like college presses and stuff. There were a lot of them that would have substantially reduced prices on their older books and even like free giveaways of many of their older books, that type of thing.
I am looking forward to continuing a tradition. I have a tradition of picking up buttons from people's tables.
Okay.
And then putting them on the AWP lanyard to create my own bandolier that just makes this awesome clacking sound wherever I go.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like a good tradition.
But looking forward to it, and looking forward to seeing you and other things there before, because we're almost out of time.
Okay.
So before we leave, though, what you got coming down? You mentioned that you just picked the first one for 2015 from Blood Pudding. What else you got coming down the pike with the press, with your work? Anything you want to promote?
Well, with the press, it was several months ago that I announced, like, basically the last few years I've been doing, like, I had a month-long time span where I am running, like, a little contest to choose the two or three chapbooks that I'm planning on publishing the next year. So the one that I just published is called Fiddle is Blood by Lauren Gordon. And it's, you know, it's available in the Blood Pudding Press shop. I'll have it at AWP. She's going to be one of the Blood Pudding Press readers at a reading that several presses are associated with at AWP. But the cool thing about her chapbook, other than its awesome content and awesome cover art, which she herself designed, is that it's poems are based on Little House on the Prairie.
Say and, what?
Yeah, Little House on the Prairie, Laura Ingalls Wilder. And but it kind of like, you know, and this is just my take on the subject matter. I, you know, other people might interpret it differently. But to me, her poetry content has kind of been a uniquely abstract approach to it. And I don't really know how to explain it other than that it's very powerful. And I got a ton of good submissions this year, but as soon as I read hers, I was just like, oh, this is a definite yes, you know? And, you know, there will be a couple other chapbooks coming out from Blood Pudding Press later this year, too. And then as far as my stuff, well, since I've been focusing on the press so much lately, I haven't been writing all that much of my own stuff, but my most recent chapbook was a collaborative chapbook published by Hyacinth Girl Press, January of this year. And it's called Mutant Neuron Codex Swarm. And it's a collaborative chapbook between me and Robert Cole. And then also, I have my second full-length poetry book coming out towards the end of this year, which I'm super-duper-duper excited about because I've been, like, I published, my first full-length was published, like, in 2008. And so I've been submitting my second one on and off for quite a few years. And now it's finally going to be published. It's going to be published by a Cleveland-based press called Crisis Chronicles Press, and the book's called Malformed Confetti.
Kick ass. That's a yeah. Great title. That's a great title. Before we leave, where can the folks find you online?
Well, probably, you know, I'm on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and all that, but I do have a website as well, so let me look up the actual website address. Well, it's basically via Weebly. So I don't. Should I give you that website address or?
Well, I'll throw up a link on the post here.
Definitely. Yes, it's via that, and then you know the chapbooks are like basically where I sell my chapbooks is I have an Etsy shop for Blood Pudding Press, and you can find them all in there, including the new one.
Cool. Well, we will definitely throw that up there and let our listeners have a chance to check that out. Julia, it has been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you as well, and thank you very much for inviting me to be part of this.
Oh, why not? You are awesome, and well, take care and have a good evening.
Okay, you too. Bye.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.